The weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world. I'm your host, Maddie Stover, a physics PhD student at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign.
And I'm Andrew Pritchard, atmospheric scientist for Nutrient Ag Solutions and on-air meteorologist for Illinois Public Media.
In this segment, we're talking about how two different governments are dealing with weather and climate research. We start here with America. The Trump administration says it is reviewing billions of dollars in federal funding for 14 states, from everything from social services to environmental programs. And each one of these states has something in common. They did not vote for President Trump. In Colorado, the administration is doubling down on plans to dismantle the country's largest federal climate research lab. NPR's Kirk Siegler reports from Boulder.
Just before Christmas, wind gusts of 100 miles an hour led forecasters to issue a rare, extreme wildfire warning in the neighborhoods beneath Boulder's Flatiron Rock formations.
There's that air falling off the Rocky Mountains.
Here, where the Rockies crash into the Great Plains, is one of the best places on the continent to study extreme weather. So climate scientist Daniel Swain says it felt surreal when, just hours after that warning, the White House announced in a tweet it was planning to dismantle the National Center for Atmospheric Research, or NCAR.
I think it was an irony that was not lost on the hundreds of atmospheric scientists who live in these neighborhoods here near NCAR in Boulder.
Swain's standing on a hiking trail beneath its sprawling campus. Now, he's with the University of California and does research with NCAR. He's not employed there, so he feels freer to speak out. He says the ironies that day kept coming.
And in fact, the electrical utility, Xcel, had shut off the electricity to NCAR preemptively to reduce the risk of a wildfire ignition.
It's NCAR's research that informs power companies to shut down the lines during extreme weather. The memory here is fresh of a wind-driven wildfire in the winter of 2021 that destroyed 1,000 homes.
The weather and climate science that's been done at NCAR has saved countless lives.
The Trump administration says the center's forecasting arm will be folded into other federal agencies, but they're putting an end to its climate change research. In response to a request for comment, the White House called the center a, quote, premier research stronghold for left-wing climate lunacy. Here's Energy Secretary Chris Wright speaking at the National Renewable Energy Lab nearby, which has been rebranded the National Lab of the Rockies.
It's a real physical phenomenon. It's worth understanding a little bit. But to call it a crisis and point to disasters and say that that's climate change, that's to say I'm not going to do my homework.
The targeting of NCAR comes as the administration is also trying to force a coal plant here to stay open against the wishes of its owners. Trump is moving to block Colorado's wolf reintroduction, and the administration cut off federal aid funds used for childcare. The Colorado leaders are more worried about an economic fallout from federal research being cut. Renewable energy is big business here. The industry says it's seeing a bump in demand for solar and batteries, partly due to the recent power shutoffs to avoid starting wildfires during high winds. Retribution campaign or not, retired federal scientists like Chuck Kutcher say Trump's attempt to turn back the clock toward fossil fuels will have ramifications far beyond Colorado.
Yeah, the energy transition will continue. The concern that I have is we're falling further and further behind China.
Kutcher worked for 40 years at the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden.
The very first climate science conference held in the world was in Boulder in 1965, and it was there because of NCAR.
Boulder today feels on edge. Hundreds of federal jobs are in limbo at labs like NCAR, NOAA, and the federal partnerships with the University of Colorado. Mayor Aaron Brockett says the political battle over NCAR started as Boulder was preparing for a possible wildfire during this, one of the driest winters on record.
The timing was terrible because we actually were preparing for the high wind event at the moment that that information dropped. So the whole city is preparing from a public safety perspective to protect our residents. And meanwhile, we're having to scramble to think about what does this mean for NCAR.
It was cruel, Mayor Brockett says. The federal government was dismantling the very institution that helps protect cities like his from extreme weather. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Boulder, Colorado.
Back here on Weather Realness, the podcast about climate and weather, Andrew, as a meteorologist who has long studied severe weather, what would dismantling the National Center for Atmospheric Research, or NCAR, mean for meteorologists like yourself?
If NCAR were dismantled, it would be a major setback for meteorologists like myself and for public safety in this country. NCAR provides the high-performance computing, the modeling systems, and the collaborative research backbone that helps us improve forecasts for hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, and wildfires, as we just heard, and other high-impact weather events. That kind of centralized infrastructure simply can't be replicated by one university or a private company. Aviation safety is a great example. Research back in the 1970s, led by NCAR, really helped us understand microbursts, these strong downbursts and thunderstorms, and that directly led to radar warning systems that have essentially eliminated those fatal U.S. airline crashes during takeoff and landing. Agriculture is another one. Advanced tools that combine weather, soil, and crop data that help farmers save water, energy, and money while reducing risk, that's all been spearheaded by NCAR. And the military relies on accurate weather intelligence for mission planning, and farmers rely on it for food production. Communities rely on it for disaster preparedness. So dismantling NCAR wouldn't just affect scientists like myself. It would weaken our forecasting capability and slow that innovation we've had over the last several decades and increase the weather risk for everyday Americans.
Do you think NCAR's ending could possibly affect severe storm forecasting here in Illinois? And if so, how?
Absolutely. I mean, NCAR research has led us to better understanding these severe storms that we get in the Midwest and across the United States, how they operate and what conditions lead to them. And that's really advanced our ability to model these storms. And not only that, the supercomputers that they house there, they've really led to the development of these new high-resolution weather forecast models where we can, you know, literally see some of the thunderstorms being modeled that may happen later on that day. And so that's really helped us hone in those forecasts, get much more specific when it comes to location of the event and also the timing of the event.
In the story, NPR reported the White House called NCAR a, quote, premier research stronghold for left-wing climate lunacy. What happens if federal research into climate change comes to an end?
Well, it's important to understand the difference, I think, sometimes between weather and climate. So weather is what's happening outside right now, and the climate is what you expect. And we have these expectations because we've kept records and decided it's kind of important to understand and have expectations for weather impacts region to region, whether it's kind of the daily or seasonal weather or what sort of disasters that that region is prone to. So local, state, and tribal governments, they rely on federal climate data to plan infrastructure projects like seawalls or stormwater systems to withstand extreme weather events. And a lack of data would lead to, you know, potentially uninformed or unsafe planning decisions.
Yeah, it really is a central puzzle piece for a lot of these weather and climate questions. So does that mean that research on climate and weather has to fall more on places like the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign? And do we have enough resources to take the place of the federal government?
Yeah, it would. I think the idea here is that, you know, universities or private entities could take this on. And to me, that's an issue, but it's also less about the resources, more about the loss of collaboration in resources. So this research would continue, but it would be done with less financial resources, and there would be redundancies because universities or research groups would have to kind of go rogue or start up their own independent organizations. And that collaborative model is already embedded in how NCAR operates. You know, it's made up of a consortium of more than 120 colleges and universities across the United States, and that represents a wide range of regions, you know, institutional types, and in different scientific backgrounds.
You're listening to Weather Realness. I'm Maddie Stover, a physics PhD student at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
And I'm Andrew Pritchard, atmospheric scientist for Nutrien Ag Solutions and on-air meteorologist for Illinois Public Media.
We talked about how the U.S. government is looking at cutting back weather and climate research, but there's a different story in another part of the world. Millions of people across this country have heard and seen weather warnings in the last few weeks about excessive cold or snow or windstorms or floods.
A winter storm this weekend that'll give us snow. Our weather alert is going to continue all the way through early next week. It's just
flash flood warnings remain in effect for Kane, Kendall, and Will County until
In many parts of the world, people have no warnings, with often deadly results. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports on an effort to change that.
The Cambodian village of Prek Tush is right next to the Mekong River. It's a fishing community, and floods are a part of life here. But like a lot of places, the floods here are getting worse because of climate change. Klee, Polly, and Sen Sara are fish sellers in town.
Did this neighborhood flood?
Water come to destroy the house.
The other voice you hear there is Tat Odum. He's a Cambodian journalist who worked with me on this story. The women told us that the water nearly destroyed their homes three times in the fall of 2025 alone. The last flood, in November, was the worst one, which was strange because usually the strongest monsoon rains come earlier than that. It's another example of climate change. As the earth heats up, the monsoon rains get less predictable. Anyway, they say during the November flood, the water was very powerful and very high.
People are gesturing like it was up to their necks?
Yeah.
The number?
Yeah.
And the slack of the...
Oh, the line above
line,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's this year?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
The water line is about 10 feet off the ground. Stuff was floating away, they say. Fishing nets, buckets, children's toys.
So this was a really bad year.
Yeah, very so bad one.
Floods like these can be deadly. Just last year, floods killed hundreds of people in five countries across Southeast Asia. One reason is that a lot of countries don't warn people about severe weather. That includes about half of the world's least developed and small island nations, according to a 2025 United Nations report. A growing consortium of UN agencies, governments, and philanthropic groups are trying to fix that problem. Since 2022, the UN, the World Bank, and other contributors have spent more than $4 billion on weather warning systems. Here's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking last year.
Disaster-related mortality is at least six times lower in countries with good early warning systems in place.
The goal is to protect everyone on Earth by 2027, although the UN acknowledges it will likely not meet that goal. Still, some places are seeing the benefits, including Cambodia, which the UN has touted as a success story. Bai Siev Meng is a disaster official in Cambodia's Tabang Khmum province, one of the most flood-prone parts of the country. In the past, a lot of people died and a lot of livestock drowned when there were big floods, he says. But not anymore, because they monitor the level of the river and warn people when floods are coming, which is what happened in the village of Prek Tush. A day before the November flood, cell phones in town started getting voicemails that sounded like this. There will be minor flooding that may affect your area in Tabang Khmum province, the warning says, before giving directions about how to evacuate. Klee Polly, the fish seller, immediately packed up her family's belongings, including their chickens. When we heard the announcement, we took our children to the safe house, she explains. That's the government-run evacuation site up the road. And you didn't need a cell phone to get the warning. The village chief hooked his phone up to a car speaker and drove through town, broadcasting the message on repeat. That's how 82-year-old Kar Sama and his wife found out. They announced it via loudspeaker, he says, and then a neighbor gave the elderly couple a ride. When the floodwaters receded, everyone returned to their homes. By the time we visited, about a month after the flood, life was back to normal. It was a hot afternoon. Kids were doing backflips off the fishing boats into the river. What happened here is an example of the profound, life-saving power of simple, low-tech weather warnings. Bai Siev Meng, the Cambodian disaster official, says international funds have reinforced what the local government and residents were already doing. The things we do here during a flood, they save lives, he says. It's not perfect. The water destroys buildings and crops. It's still economically devastating. But it's less deadly than it used to be. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
That story was field produced by Ryan Kelman and Mom Sopan.
Andrew, as a person who studies severe storms here in the U.S., have you heard about how storm warnings are issued in other countries?
Yeah, so we know that here in the U.S. we have a great warning system that pushes alerts sometimes to your phone with that little, you know, buzzing noise and, you know, for a tornado warning or sometimes, you know, snow squall warnings or these derechos and significant severe storms that we get. And there's similar alerting systems in other countries. The U.K. established a system back in 2023 that sends out mobile push notifications. Japan has a mobile alert system that's part of a program called J-Alert, and those are broadcast to, you know, TVs, outdoor speakers, radios, through email, and they're delivered to handsets, you know, via Japanese, you know, cell phone companies as well. But there's also an app that you can download, which is handy if you're traveling in that area. There's similar alerts in Australia, where they send out phone calls and text messages for things like bushfires. And same thing up in Canada. You know, cell phone providers are required to send emergency alerts to devices on their networks in some of these countries. But that is not the given, you know, everywhere, as we just heard. And it is true that these alerting systems make a huge difference in fatality rates when it comes to weather disasters.
Good to know if you're planning to travel, maybe just be aware of some of those alert systems internationally. Was there a time when early warning systems in the United States resembled that of Cambodia? And what difference has, you know, recent improvements in United States early warning systems made in saving lives?
Absolutely. It's one of my favorite things to go back and read is the history of us trying to figure out and understand these crazy storms that we got here in the United States and figuring out how to warn people. And so if you go back to the late 1800s, mentioning tornadoes in U.S. weather forecasts was actually banned because they thought that it would incite too much panic. We didn't really understand them enough to be forecasting them. And that ban lasted all the way up until about 1950. And this was following a successful forecast by Air Force meteorologists back in 1948. And this was kind of a pattern recognition. A tornado had hit this Air Force base in Oklahoma. And then, you know, you fast forward to another day and the meteorologists there at the base recognized very similar weather conditions. And so they issued kind of a secret tornado warning. And the base was actually impacted by a tornado later that day. So in 1950, we removed the ban on mentioning tornadoes here in the United States and started issuing some of these initial tornado warnings. And then with the advancement of Doppler radar in the 1980s and 90s, that greatly improved the accuracy of our tornado warnings. So if you look at tornado warnings in the U.S., they've really reduced annual fatalities by about 50% since the 1950s, with the fatality rate per million residents dropping by over 90% from 1925 to 2000. And so if you just kind of look at the advancements that we've made here, you know, back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, it was not uncommon to have 300 to 500 fatalities in a year in the United States. And now that number is often somewhere between 50 to 100.
I feel like folks in my generation, Gen Z, will really take for granted the really great forecasting abilities we have.
Absolutely, yeah. It's something that's taken for granted of and sometimes seen as an annoyance here in this country.
So with global climate change taking place, are you glad to hear countries like Cambodia have better access to storm warnings?
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the difference here, it was mentioned in that story here that, you know, the mortality rate from these disasters is six times higher in these countries without robust weather warning systems. And with the idea being that we're going to see some of these, you know, increasingly extreme weather events, these flooding events, it's imperative that we get this information to folks who are going to be impacted by that so they can, you know, make preparations to save their lives, but also to try to prevent, you know, extreme damage to infrastructure down there as well. It just makes an enormous difference when you've got time to get prepared for these weather events.
So as we alluded to before, here in Illinois, we can get storm warnings on our phones, as well as on radio, TV, and storm sirens placed throughout town. But do you think people take these warnings seriously? And as we talked about before, how do we kind of prevent this mindset of taking these warnings for granted?
Absolutely. I think that there's sometimes, you know, a misunderstanding around some of the alerting systems. I hear a lot about the outdoor warning sirens that we've got here, people who, you know, can't hear them inside their house, and you have to remind them the purpose is to alert people outdoors to head inside and seek further information. And so I think it's really about communicating how these alerts are sent out, understanding the information within them, and then also just on scientists. It's always on us to continue the research to reduce that false alarm rate. And I think that we've done a good job of that over the last several decades. But at the end of the day, these events are very localized. I mean, we can, you know, sound the alarms for a big tornado outbreak, and maybe that big tornado just misses your town or something like that. And we develop this kind of misconception that the big storms always, you know, split and go around my town, or it never actually happens to me, because it usually doesn't happen to you until the one time that it doesn't. So it could be a bit of an annoyance here, you know, if we have an active year where it seems like you're being told to go to your basement, you know, every single day or something like that. Just take the warning seriously. It's 30 minutes, 45 minutes of your time, and that decision may save your life.
Yeah, kind of along the lines of, you know, taking this high-tech forecasting for granted. Maybe folks who are a little bit closer to my age, maybe go talk to your grandparents or parents about what sort of warning systems they had in their time. And we'll probably see that a buzz on our phone, you know, 3 or 4 times a month is not too bad.
No, definitely not.
That is today's Weather Realness. I'm Maddie Stover, a physics PhD student at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign.
And I'm Andrew Pritchard, an atmospheric scientist for Nutrien Ag Solutions and on-air meteorologist for Illinois Public Media.
Weather Realness is produced by
Jeff Frame,
Trent Ford,
Steve Nesbitt,
Reginald Hardwick,
and myself, Maddie Stover. Funding for this podcast is partially provided by the Backlund Charitable Trust. Weather Realness is produced by the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media. We'll talk with you again next week.